Hey, everybody, listen up. I got mega huge news. Meat Eater Live is heading back out on the road. That's right. Join me and the crew. Clay Newcomb, Cal, Yanni, Spencer's going to be there. Phil the Engineer is going to be there. Meat Eater Live, headed back out. Now, when you get every ticket, okay, every ticket you buy, you get a signed copy of our new Meat Eater Outdoor Cookbook. This tour is celebrating the release of the book. Buy a ticket, get a signed copy, Meat Eater Outdoor Cookbook, wild game recipes for the grill, smoker, camp stove, and campfire, which I'll point out is a $38 value. Here's where we're going to go. April 23rd, the Mesa Arts Center in Mesa, Arizona. April 24th, the Balboa Theater in San Diego. April 25th, the Grove in Anaheim, California. April 27th, the Crest Theater in Sacramento. April 29, the Union in Salt Lake City. April 30, the Egyptian in Boise. May 1, the Wilma Theater in Missoula. May 2, the Bing Crosby Theater in Spokane, Washington. May 4, Revolution Hall in Portland, Oregon. And May 5, the last day of the tour, Pantages Theater in Tacoma, Washington. For tickets and more information, visit the events page at TheMeatEater.com. Hope to see you at the show.
Welcome to the Wired to Hunt podcast, your guide to the whitetail woods. Presented by First Light, creating proven versatile hunting apparel for the stand, saddle, or blind. First Light, go farther, stay longer. And now, your host, Mark Kenyon.
Welcome to the Wired to Hunt podcast. This week on the show, we are discussing the increasing challenges of finding free hunting permission in these days and specific strategies for still being able to gain that access with our guest, Spencer Newharth. All right, welcome back to the Wired to Hunt podcast brought to you by First Light and their Camo for Conservation initiative. Camo for Conservation is a program in which a portion of every sale of First Light Spectre camo pattern, a portion of those sales goes to support the National Deer Association. Love it. And I love our topic and our guest today on the podcast because we're talking about access. We started this little mini-series last week. We talked about leases. And now today we are talking about getting hunting permission, free permission, access to places to hunt, regardless of how much money and what kind of resources you have available to you. And I think this is obviously a very, very important topic. It's something that I have been working on for a whole lot of years, trying to figure out how to do this. And I think the general consensus that most people are reaching now is that it's getting harder. When I started really getting into this 15, 20 years ago, the trying to gain permission for myself, it was a lot harder then than it was 50 years ago. And that trend continues as I think, you know, just natural things are happening. There is high demand for places to hunt. And when there's more people all trying to find places to hunt in those increasingly rare, open, undeveloped landscapes where you can hunt, so demand is going up, supply is going down, right? You're going to have challenges there. So that is inevitable in our world. And this is not going to change likely. So we need to continue to find ways to get better at this, get creative with this, have a plan in place to make sure that we can still have locations to hunt. Of course, we've got public land, which we are so, so fortunate to have access to. And that continues to be an incredible resource for us deer hunters and any kind of hunter or angler. But man, still, there's something to be said about finding a piece of private land that you can get access to, you can stumble onto or find or work really hard to get access to some great stuff in this kind of way. So that's the plan, is we are going to break down specific strategies, specific tactics, processes you can put in place to gain hunting permission. And my guest is my pal and permission extraordinaire, Spencer Newharth. You might remember him as a longtime co-host of mine, and he ran our Rut Fresh radio series for many, many years here at Wired to Hunt. He now hosts the Meat Eater Trivia podcast, So he's still in the Meat Eater universe. He's still in my world. We just haven't got to hear from him as often here on Wired Hunt. So I'm excited to have him back. And he's a guy who's kind of specialized in getting permission and doing it in a number of different ways. So that's what I'm excited about in this particular chat, because he can give us really good ideas on, you know, how to assess the quality of a piece of property as whether or not you should be interested in trying to get access to it. He's got ideas about how to get permission by knocking on doors. He's done it by phone calls. He's done it through social media. And he's done it through letter writing campaigns, actually. So we discuss all of those different approaches. So no matter if you are a people person or not, if you are terrified by the idea of going up to a stranger, or if you are excited by that idea, there's going to be a tactic that you can try coming out of this chat. So that's the plan. I want to give you one quick heads up on something, and then I want to give you a few of my own thoughts on this before we get Spencer on the line. Now, number one, quick kind of public service announcement. I don't even know when this was. I guess it would have been early this winter, maybe. We dropped our first new Wired Hunt merchandise in years. I had a new hat that's being sold on the Meat Eater store. It's got a really cool, I should have been wearing it for this one, but there's a really cool deer illustration across the front, and it says Wired Hunt on the side over there. Well, we're almost out of them. We're almost completely sold out. So if you want to get one of the last handful of Wired Hunt hats on this run, head on over to themeateater.com, or there's actually a link in the description for this podcast today, so you can click that. I do not know if we're going to have another run of these. I do not know if there will be more. If there will be different colors next time, or if there will be different styles, no idea yet. I think it's probably going to be determined on whether or not we sell out of these, which it seems like we're going to. And if that's the case, hopefully there will be support to get some new stuff. But get these while they last, because I just don't know what's coming next. So that's the first heads up. Wired Hunt hats are nearing zero. Check them out now. And that's, I guess, that's really it. There are two other things, I suppose, worth noting. The Meat Eater live tour is, depending on when you're listening to this, I think it's kicking off very, very soon. So if you are in the west part of the United States, that's where the Meat Eater live tour is this year. Head on over to themeateater.com to get more details on that. And then finally, there's a new thing that Meat Eater is launching called Meat Eater Experiences. This is going to be an opportunity for folks to join the Meat Eater crew, people like Steve, Giannis, Kale, myself and Tony even, on fishing or hunting trips. I'll let you get into all the details over on the website if that's something that you are intrigued by, but that's the thing. Meat Eater Experiences, that is available to learn all about at themeateater.com as well. So that is it for housekeeping and updates. Now, let's talk a little bit about permission. And I just want to give you a few of my thoughts, you know, from my own experience before we get Spencer on here. And I think the biggest thing, and we do talk about this a little bit, but I want to emphasize it here at the beginning, is that getting hunting permission in 2024 or 2025, 26, 27, whenever it is that you're listening to this, it is really a numbers game. It's going to come down to how much effort are you willing to put into this? How hard are you willing to work at this? How many attempts are you going to have, right? How many swings at the ball? If you want to hit home runs, right, you're not going to hit them every time. You're not going to hit them one out of every 10 times probably, right? You need to try over and over and over and over again and not be disheartened when you get a bunch of no's, because you are going to get a lot of no's. Whether you're knocking on doors, whether you're sending letters, whether you are, you know, asking friends and family members in random conversations whenever you find out somebody owns land, right? We're asking a lot, if you think about it, asking for someone to let us, maybe we're random strangers, let us have free hunting access to their hard-earned land, to a resource that they've put sweat, money, tears into maybe, and then expect, you know, hey, we just think we should be able to walk out there and use their thing. That's a big ask. So we should not be surprised that people are hesitant, that people are unsure, that people have reservations about that, or the fact that they just don't want you using their stuff when they've got other people they know that already do. So like we're taking a flyer. Like this is a moonshot right out the gate. Don't be surprised when your moonshot does not land on the moon every time, okay? That's a big thing. I think if we go into this with the wrong expectations, we can be beat down quickly, get depressed by it, and quit. That will not lead to getting hunting permission. You got to go into this knowing it's going to be 96% no's. And every time you get one of those no's, rather than looking at that as, ah, crap, this sucks, I got another no, I would encourage you to instead, every time you get a no, think to yourself, all right, I'm one step closer to that yes, because I've checked another no off the list. We're getting closer. We're getting closer. So actually, that's good news because you are closer to what you want. Keep that in mind throughout this process. Number two, and again, this is something that Spencer brings up, and Spencer uses this to his advantage as well, but I want to kind of sign off on it, I guess, as someone who agrees with him. And that is the fact that, you know, you should always be looking for hunting permission. And by that, I mean, like, have this thing going on in the back of your mind in which you are always lighting up and paying attention when you happen to hear of an opportunity, when you happen to hear of someone who owns land, when you happen to hear of someone who has a great aunt who lives on 80 acres, when you happen to hear of a coworker who mentions the fact that they grew up on a family farm, but you know, now nobody goes back there anymore. When you hear anything like that, when you hear that your neighbor just bought a new house on 10 acres and you know they don't hunt, anytime there's that possibility, like you hear of land and it sounds like, well, maybe it's not getting hunted, or maybe you just don't know, it's worth asking. It's worth having those conversations. It's always worth throwing it out there. You know, let's say your buddy, like I just said, buddy buys a new house. It's on 10 acres. It's back in the woods. He talks about, man, it's awesome. You know, been seeing deer behind the house, yada, yada, yada. And then all of a sudden you're thinking, 10 acres. That's not nothing. He doesn't hunt. Can't hurt. Hey, man, you know I'm into hunting. I lost two spots this past year. What do you think about me ever going out there and bow hunting, you know, a few weekends? If you do those little things, if you ask those questions throughout a year to lots of different people in natural ways when they naturally come up, if you ask it, if you're constantly asking around, if your aunts and uncles and grandparents and buddies all know that you're always asking for folks, like, hey, is there maybe a chance I could hunt there? If they all know that, then when opportunities do arise, when your aunt hears from her friend, like, oh yeah, I used to have guys that hunted my spot, but they were jerks and I kicked them off. All of a sudden your aunt's going to know, well, I know that Joe is always looking for places and that sounds like this place is open. I should get a hold of my nephew Joe and let him know. Like, make sure the world knows of your intent and your interest. If you do that, it's amazing how the world will present you opportunities. All right, so those are two big things I want you to think about. This is a numbers game, and you always need to be like sending out your hopes and desires when it comes to hunting access, because you never know when it's going to work. Like, you're throwing spaghetti at the wall, and you never know when it's going to stick or what's going to stick, but nothing will stick if you're not constantly throwing spaghetti. All right, so there's your unique permissions analogy of the day. Finally, I would suggest you think about ways that you can provide value to landowners. Because, right, we know that landowners can provide us value because we don't own land and we're looking to use their land. So they have something we want. What do we have that they might want? What can we provide? How can we give back to them? Because, as I mentioned earlier, we're asking a lot of them. It's reasonable to think that they might ask something of us. My buddy Doug Duran has a great program and a great example of one way to think about this. So Doug has started this thing called Sharing the Land, in which he is trying to connect landowners who have work that they want done, conservation work, habitat work, farm projects that they need done on their land. He wants to connect people like that who have a demand for help with access seekers, hunters, or anybody else who wants access to private land to hunt or bird or fish or something like that. He's got those people who need land and who have able bodies and the willingness to help. And he's trying to help connect these folks and find ways that we can find win-win situations where, you know, somebody who wants permission to hunt can go and be connected with a landowner, and this landowner needs help tearing down fences or planting cover crops or removing invasive species, something like that. He needs workers. He needs helpers. And then you can find this hunter who wants to hunt their land in exchange for doing some of that work, for putting in an investment of conservation effort by helping out in the landscape. You then get access to hunt it. Really cool program. You can learn more about it at sharingtheland.com. But if, you know, if the pieces of permission that Doug has listed on his site, which he does have, you know, landowners who are looking for people now, if there's not something there in your area, think about taking that same concept and that same idea and applying it wherever you live. So think about people maybe that you know. Maybe you do know some farmers who need some help, or who you know are pressed for time, or who, you know, have talked to you about this problem and that problem, this project they wish they could get to. Why don't you offer up your services? Why don't you say, hey, you know, I've been doing a lot of work on, understanding soil health, or I was a landscaper in high school or college. I'm pretty good at digging holes. Whatever it is that you can offer up, offer to help, offer to do work on the farm, offer to take something off their plate that they don't want on there and demonstrate that you can bring value to the table. If you can do that, you are much more likely to be able to get hunting access and permission. And I think you'll be more invested in the process too, and maybe even appreciate it all that much more. That is my final thought here. I will give you a couple more suggestions. If you want to dive deeper into this topic of gaining and finding hunting access, you know, number one, you can go back and listen to last week's episode in which we focused on the kind of pay to hunt way, which is a hunting lease. Hate them or love them, they are a thing now that are becoming more and more of an option people are turning to. And I want to make sure we talk about how to do that the smartest way. So that's a discussion you might want to go listen to. We also have a lot of articles on the Meat Eater website about this topic. And I want to give you three specific examples that you can go look up now and read if you want more reading. So we've got one from Tony called Why Spring is the Best Time to Get Deer Hunting Permission. You can go search that title and find that and read it. Another one by me, just titled How to Find Hunting Permission. That breaks down my personal process. Another one by Tony called Tips for Finding a Fresh Whitetail Hunting Spot Right Now. So check those three out if you want more on this topic. But before we do anything like that, before any Googling or searching or heading on over to your web browser, right now, we have a very thorough, in-depth discussion about how to gain deer hunting permission in 2024 and in these changing times moving forward. And my guest, Spencer Newhart, is going to help us take it from here. All right, back with me again. For the first time, I think, since he walked out on me like a groom left at the aisle by the bride, just walked right out of my life. Spencer Newhart, welcome back to the show, buddy.
Thanks, Marcus. It's fun. You should just ask me back more often. It's not as though I'm like turning down invites to be on Wired Hunt. I feel like you walked out on me as well. I've tried to rekindle this, and it just hasn't happened.
Well, I prefer the way that I positioned it the first time, but we'll just move forward from here.
Sure.
Water under the bridge. No crying over spilt milk. I'm glad to be chit-chatting with you again and talking whitetails, which do you get to do very often there at HQ, or you kind of hide that part of you?
Yeah, no, it's uncommon to get to talk whitetails, and when I am talking whitetails, it feels like it's in defense of whitetails and whitetail hunters. Folks in this studio tend to have a very prickly attitude about hunters who sit in tree stands or like to hunt America's most popular big game animal. So this will be a pleasant podcast when it comes to whitetails and different than what I'm used to lately.
Yeah, buddy, you're in the trust tree right now. You're in a safe place. Mm-hmm. Yes, this is safe. You're with your people. So the thing we're talking about today, and the thing we've talked about for a couple of weeks now, buddy, is access. And I don't know if you've experienced this, but it seems like, you know, over the last well, not even just the last 20, 30 years, but even this last 5 years, it seems like it's been getting even more difficult to get access to places. And this is a common thing. This is not news to anyone. People have been talking about this and complaining about this for quite a while. But today I want to specifically focus on permission, like free permission. We've talked about leases. We've talked about some other things, but today it's can you still get free permission? Which it seems like some people are starting to say no, like that's a relic of the past, or at least a lot of folks are starting to not want to do the things maybe that are required to get that. But you're a guy that I know who still seems to be, you know, riding that horse. So I guess I wanted to press you on some details around that today. Are you game for that?
Yeah, happy to share. It's I would, as far as if I were to identify the strengths of myself as a whitetail hunter, I think finding places to hunt is one of them.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel like watching you from afar, I would agree with that. That's been a thing that I've thought to myself, like, you've got it figured out. You don't have that, I feel a certain sense of reservations about like just like going and knocking on doors. Like, sure. I don't like it. I'll do it. I know I have to do it sometimes, but I've never been a big fan of it.
Yeah.
But I see you like, you know, run random place in Wyoming and you've got half a day and boom, you've got a spot. So that's why you're here. That's why I want to talk to you.
Okay. Let's get into it.
To get to kind of set the stage though, can you fill us in on your kind of like access history? Have you been knocking on doors or sending letters and getting permission for free from the get-go? Or what has that evolution been like for you?
Yeah, I think it started when I was in high school, and I grew up in a family that deer hunted but didn't turkey hunt. And where I grew up in southeastern South Dakota, turkey habitat seems to be very fractured. And I feel like there's some states, maybe like a Kentucky or an Illinois or a Georgia, you can look at a piece of land from a road or from like aerial. And if it has timber, it just seems like it has turkeys. And that's not the case where I grew up. And the places that I had always deer hunted did not have turkeys. And so when I was interested in turkey hunting, I sort of had to strike out on my own and find places to hunt. And I guess that was the genesis of me knocking on doors, calling landowners, sending letters, was trying to find places to turkey hunt. And so that started, I don't know, probably when I was like a junior in high school. And then when I went off to college, I went to college that was a little over an hour away from home. And I still wanted to be able to hunt weekdays. And it was a place that didn't have hardly any public land. And so there again, that was like the next chapter. Okay, now I need to find hunting permissions for deer because I'd like to hunt on a Wednesday and I don't want to drive an hour back home. So that was the beginning of it for me.
Do you remember what those early days were like? Like the first door you knocked on or some of those early interactions, were you like Rico Suave with a deep baritone voice, like nailing it right out the get-go, or did you struggle at first?
No, I struggled. It was especially hard for me to talk to a stranger about it. And I think my first interactions were with folks that I was familiar with, like somebody that I knew their dad because I went to school with their kid, or someone who was my math teacher in middle school. I started off with like folks that I felt like were within my network. And if I did have to talk to a stranger, that was typically unsuccessful and a thing that I had to like hype myself up for a lot. And often that wasn't enough either for it to be like easy for me to go ask somebody for permission. So the early days, were much tougher and I've now realized as I've gotten older that, hey, worst case scenario is you're going to say no, and that's okay. And that happens a lot. And then you just move on. It's never been the case like on when you were hunting in, what was it, Washington, D.C., where the cops were called.
Yeah.
That's unusual. that doesn't happen. Yes. You know, you might envision that the worst case scenario is that, but the reality is it isn't. They're typically pretty pleasant, or they're not unpleasant experiences. And again, they might say no, but that's okay.
Okay. But it's not always, or at least from my experience, it's not always rainbows and butterflies, even when they do say no. You haven't had the cops called in, but have you had anything weird happen, or what's the worst thing that you have had happen? So you must have been in some kind of awkward situation or something over the years.
The worst thing that I've had happen. I would guess it's like encountering somebody who is anti-hunting or someone who feels like they have to go over the top to tell me no. Almost insulting or something like that. And that can be unpleasant. But nothing that's ever been like a disaster. And so I guess the good news is, if something isn't sticking out to me as being like a really bad scenario, then I think that says that bad things don't happen all that often, I guess. And I feel like I've contacted quite literally hundreds of landowners over the year. And when it goes bad, it's not all that bad. I guess worst case scenario, nothing comes to mind for me.
Hey, everybody, listen up. I got mega huge news. Meat Eater Live is heading back out on the road. That's right. Join me and the crew. Clay Newcomb, Cal, Yanni, Spencer's going to be there. Phil the Engineer is going to be there. Meat Eater Live, headed back out. Now, when you get every ticket, okay, every ticket you buy, you get a signed copy of our new Meat Eater Outdoor Cookbook. This tour is celebrating the release of the book. Buy a ticket, get a signed copy, Meat Eater Outdoor Cookbook, wild game recipes for the grill, smoker, camp stove, and campfire, which I'll point out is a $38 value. Here's where we're going to go. April 23rd, the Mesa Arts Center in Mesa, Arizona. April 24th, the Balboa Theater in San Diego. April 25th, the Grove in Anaheim, California. April 27th, the Crest Theater in Sacramento. April 29th, the Union in Salt Lake City. April 30th, the Egyptian in Boise. May 1st, the Wilma Theater in Missoula. May 2nd, the Bing Crosby Theater in Spokane, Washington. May 4th, Revolution Hall in Portland, Oregon. And May 5th, the last day of the tour, Pantages Theater in Tacoma, Washington. For tickets and more information, visit the events page at themeateater.com. Hope to see you at the show.
So I'll give you one of my worst case scenarios, other than the cop one.
Yeah.
One time I was with, and this was kind of, I was just on the sidelines for this one sort of, but I was with a buddy and we were driving around Southern Ohio trying to find a place to hunt. And there were some times when we were worried that both of us going up there at once would kind of be like overwhelming, like too many people asking for too much permission. So for most of them, he would lead or we'd take turns. And so on this house, he led, and he in particular had a belief, and there might be truth to this, that the more sketchy a looking house it is, the better chance you have of getting permission on the farm. Right? Because if you go to like a really fancy, very expensive home and they've got 100 acres and, you know, knock on that door, like, for sure, they bought the place because they want to use it for themselves or whatever. But you might be able to find like that very rundown, middle of nowhere place where, you know, they're very okay with whatever, you know, they're okay with it. Yeah. They don't have a bunch of people already there. They didn't buy this place specifically because they wanted to kill huge giant bucks, whatever. Yeah. They've just been there. So his angle was like, we seek out that kind of place.
Sure.
And so I just remember this one particular place, like it was, you know, like missing windows, hadn't been painted in 40 years. There's every old tractor, every old car, every old bicycle that this family had owned for 50 years in the lawn. Goes up to the front door. Gentleman opens the door in his underwear still and like a very stained wife beater. And then my buddy, he asked him into his house. And so you can't say no to that.
Yeah.
So then he goes into the house and I can't see what's going on anymore. And so I'm sitting there just thinking, okay, like it looked like, you know, just like, it just kind of looked like the beginning of like one of those movies where someone doesn't come out of the house.
And, yeah, it seems very cinematic.
Yes. And so I just remember thinking, like, after 10 minutes, like, do I need to get up and go check? And then after 15 minutes, like, do I need to be worried? After like 20 minutes, like, I'm thinking seriously, okay, I should just like go walk up there and like try to, you know, it's probably fine. They're just probably in there having coffee or talking, but right. I probably need to like just check on the situation. So I just remember for 20 minutes stressing about like what's going on. And then finally, right before I was about to go and get in there, they came back out and then I was waved in. And then, you know, from there, it was fine. But you just find yourself in all sorts of kind of interesting or awkward or strange situations.
Did you get permission?
We did not get permission.
Oh, so what was going on for that 20 minutes?
Just want to chit chat.
Okay.
Like, yeah. I found that a lot. Like when you, especially like certain parts of the country that aren't as busy, I think. Like, right? If you live far out there.
Yep.
You don't have a lot of visitors. So sometimes we would have people that just want to talk or like they'll hear you out and then they tell you about Bob and their uncle who so-and-so. And like before, you know, you just never know where those conversations are going to go. Mm-hmm. And I've always thought you never rush yourself out of it.
Sure.
Like one thing I've learned over the years is like, if they want to chat, let them chat, be polite, be respectful. Like you pushed yourself on them in the first place.
Yes.
So, you know, don't be rude pushing yourself out. And then at the same time, you never know what might happen. Like I've had situations where they say no at first, but then they just keep talking and they get to know you a little bit more and you're there an hour and you've told them your life story and they've told you their life story. And by the end of it, they're like, oh, you know what?
Yeah,
sure. You could hunt.
Yep.
So that's all a long-winded way of getting to what I really wanted to ask you about, Spencer, which is, you've been through the ringer. You've done it for many years since high school. Where have you landed? I think I know, but where have you landed as far as what you think is your preferred mode now of getting permission?
My preferred mode, I think it is hardest to turn me down in person. If I am like, you know, a person-to-person exchange at their front door or something, that seems to be where I have the most success. And if I were to like, think about the ways that I have the best odds of getting permission. I would say face-to-face are the best odds for me. At the bottom of the list is probably like the most indirect, which would be probably letter writing. I send Facebook messages to folks if I can find a landowner on Facebook. Those things have worked out for me, but at a lower rate than face-to-face. And then somewhere in between there would be making a phone call. That's, you know, between face-to-face and between sending a digital message or a physical letter would be a phone call. So if I'm local to the area, I prefer to go talk to them. If that's not the case, I prefer to call them on the phone. And in other situations, I will send them a Facebook message. And then in like very specific examples, I will shotgun out a bunch of letters to people to which, you know, I feel like the last time I did that was a couple of years ago here in Montana. I think I sent out, it was like 111 or 118 letters, something like that. And I think of that 118, I had gotten 3 permissions where I got access to hunt something. And I feel like I only heard back from probably like 10 to 20 people. And then the other, you know, that leaves about 100 letters that were just totally unanswered. And that's fine. And there's like pros and cons to any approach. And the pro to that was I could contact a ton of people at once. The con was that I was likely never going to hear back. But it's just one approach. I don't put all my eggs in one specific basket, but prefer face to face, but I'll try anything.
All right. I want to dig into all of those, but you ended with the letter thing, and the letter thing is something that I think you're kind of known for a little bit. That's a little bit more unique. So that's not bad. Like you sent out 118 letters, you got 3 permissions. Like I know the percentage rate isn't good, but you got 3 new permissions. Like that, like a lot of folks would be stoked to get permission on 3 new properties in a year.
Yep.
What was the lift? Like how long does it take you to send out 118 letters? Are we talking like hours and hours or days and days and days? Or is this like, I put in 4 hours and I got 3 new properties?
Yeah. some parts of it are like a grueling process, like finding 118 properties that you want to hunt. That is a ton of time on Onyx. Sometimes I will like dedicate hours on a Saturday morning to be on my computer and find places that I'd be interested in hunting. And I will label those with a very specific pin on Onyx. I think I do like a purple X or whatever. Like, this is a place I'm interested in, right? And then actually writing the addresses down is another thing. Maybe at this point with like AI, there's a quicker way to do this, and you could like mass produce some letterhead with the addresses on it. You know, as of like 3 years ago, that wasn't the case for me. And so you're spending a ton of hours just finding 118 properties, and then you're spending a lot of hours like writing somebody's address on a letter. Actually writing the letter, that probably took me a couple hours as well. And this, that was the approach I took. They weren't specific to landowners. In fact, I heard back from a landowner who said that he didn't like how he knew it was very impersonal because I started off with "Dear Landowner," which he had correctly identified that I was reaching out to a ton of folks. And he didn't like that. And you know, not that I would have gotten permission if I would have put like "Dear Mark" on it. Yeah. But, you know, that lowered my odds as well, not making them personalized. And so I think if I were to do it again, I would probably go to a smaller list of landowners and make them more personalized. I think that would up my odds. But as far as the input into the thing, it's, yeah, days of work to identify the properties, hours of work to address the envelopes, and then it's very quick beyond that to add the stamps and drop them off to the post office. But it's, again, it's a thing you can do like from your kitchen table at home, which makes it valuable in its own way.
Yeah. What's your criteria when you're looking at Onyx to choose these properties that you want to get access to from afar? Because like, these are places you've not been able to see before. Mm-hmm. So what are you looking for when you're going through that process?
I think naturally folks would be inclined to pick out the best deer hunting properties, which is what I did as well when I started seeking properties in college. And I remember like the first day I had to hype myself out to go out and knock on doors. I was picking out like the 25 you know, best properties in the area, and I didn't get a single permission. And I look back on that now and I'm like, well, duh. You know, if it looked that good, if it was a manicured property, other folks are already hunting it, either for themselves or they have a neighbor or a nephew or a cousin, whatever that may be. So, I lower my, like criteria for a good deer property. If you were to grade them A, B, C, D, I'm almost never sending out letters for A's. You know, B is more rare, but most commonly I'm looking for properties that, you would say this is like a C, on a school grading scale for how good it might be for deer hunting. Because I think less folks are then asking that person to hunt. It's less likely, that they hunt it themselves. And that's good for you if you're looking for permission. The other thing is, this is something that's become more popular for me because I live in a place that does have a lot of public land. Probably like 30 or 40% of the time, I'm asking a landowner if I can use their property to backdoor a piece of public land that is otherwise very difficult to get into. And I've had a lot of success with that. It's a much lower ask for them, you know, and I make it very clear that like, I'm not asking to hunt your place. I would just be crossing your property on foot to get to the public land that I am looking to hunt. And I've even had like those situations turn into, and if you'd like to, you can also hunt, on my side of the fence. So that's the other thing. Sometimes it's less about looking for, the piece of private land that you want to hunt and more about, finding the piece of private land that gets you to a good piece of public land that others don't have access to. So that's, you know, my evolution of asking for permissions are looking for C properties and looking for properties that get me access to a piece of public. And then the other thing is if I do get a yes from a landowner, that is very powerful locally for getting other permissions. I've had that snowball a lot. I had this happen in Wyoming where I went and asked a landowner to hunt, and he had a few thousand acres, and then he said, well, my brother also owns, you know, the neighboring farm, and you can hunt that place. And so immediately I unlocked, you know, a couple more properties that way, and then I go talk to that person's neighbor, and I say, hey, you know, I'm around here for a few days, I'm deer hunting, I'm from Montana, and I actually got permission from your neighbor, Mark Kenyon, to let me hunt. And I was wondering if I could hunt your place as well. And that is sort of me telling that landowner that their neighbor feels comfortable with me being on their land. And that like really ups my success. You're significantly more likely to get permission on a neighbor's land, if their neighbor has also let you hunt. And so, that becomes like an all hands on deck situation for me. If I get permission on a place, I'm now bugging all the neighbors and whatever else is local. If I think that that landowner's name is going to be recognized, when I talk to that other person.
Yeah. I've had a kind of a similar thing happen, but with a no. Mm. So whenever I get a no on a random door knock,
yep,
I always end by asking them, hey, you know, is there anybody else in the area that you might think would be more willing to allow someone like me to go out there and bow hunt?
Yep.
And if ever I get, well, yeah, you should try Bill down the road. Like I always go there, and then I can open with like the referral.
Yeah.
Like, hey, my name is Mark. You know, Bob down the street mentioned, I was just talking to Bob. Bob mentioned I should come, you know, check in with you about yada, 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 yada. And so kind of implicitly, there's a little bit of a connection there too. Like anytime I feel like you can make it seem like you have a connection to the community or like some kind of reason to be there. Like if I'm doing this locally, I'm like, hey, I live down on X Street. Can I yada, yada, yada. Or yep. I know my buddy Ross lives and hunts down on 115th Street mm-hmm. or whatever. Can I, like, I always lead with anything I can to connect me to some kind of reference point, I guess is what yes. I'm looking for here.
Yep.
And that seems to help some.
Yeah, it gives you a local tie that you may not otherwise have. And like I said, I think it just makes that landowner more comfortable if they know that another landowner was comfortable enough to let you hunt.
Yeah. Now back to the letters. So yes. You established how you find all these properties.
Mm-hmm.
What's actually in that letter? So I know you've used the generic dear landowner, which doesn't work as well.
Yep.
So you said you would go more specific, more mm-hmm. personable.
Yep.
What would you recommend including in that letter now that you've learned a few tough lessons, but at the same time you've had success too?
Yeah, I keep it one page for sure. I don't want to go beyond that because I think it's less likely that they'll finish the dang thing in that case. I'll open up and I'll tell them who I am. I don't say anything about my career because I've found that in some cases that makes people more uncomfortable. I've lost permission on like a farm in Wyoming to hunt because we were filming 1 week in November one time and I had to get them to sign a film release to allow us to like film yeah. on their piece of land, which is something we have to go through if we're filming a hunt, right? Whether it's on public land or private land, we have to have film releases signed. And those are kind of intimidating documents, right? They're like six pages. Yeah. And it's a big ask for that landowner. And so there was one property where I used to have permission when I wasn't filming. And then we came there to film 1 week in November one time. And I lost permission to hunt that place because it made them very uneasy having a cameraman around. And so I don't tell folks what I do at all. That would be different, I think, if you had a more like admirable career, if you were a teacher or in the military, if you were a first responder. Tell folks that you do that thing. I think that would up your odds of getting permission. So anyway, I tell folks who I am. I say where I live. When it comes to saying where I live, Bozeman has a certain reputation, so I don't say Bozeman. We have like a sleeper community outside of Bozeman called Belgrade. I say I'm from Belgrade, Montana, and people won't recognize that name, which is good in this case. Then they assume it's like a small community. But Bozeman has a different reputation. That is, if someone has like thoughts about that place, they're probably negative. And so I don't say I'm from Bozeman. And again, if you're, I would think about that too. Probably every state, certain communities have reputations, certain license plates have reputations. I lived in the biggest city in South Dakota for a little while. That was Sioux Falls. And those people have license plates that have a one on them. Right. And, you know, whenever you're out hunting and you see somebody with a one license plate, you're like, you know, that damn person or whatever.
City slicker.
Yeah, exactly. And it means nothing, but it does to some people. And say, I wouldn't say I'm from Sioux Falls. I would say I grew up in a small town called Menno. And so I'd think about that, how you're presenting, you know, where you live, what your career is. I think if you have children who are interested in hunting, I think that's very powerful. I don't, but if I had my 12-year-old this year is hoping to get his first deer, I think that would make a landowner far more willing to let you hunt. So I'll tell folks who I am. I'll then explain, you know, why I'm reaching out to this person, because you never get letters from strangers anymore. At least I don't. And so, you know, it's already kind of a unique experience that they're getting a letter, and I'll tell them, I'm a deer hunter from Montana, and I'd love to come hunt this place this year. I actually drew a tag. I'll tell them, you know, when I plan to be there, and like for how many days. I think that's very important. There's a difference in asking for hunting permission for an entire season, which, you know, if it's archery, that's like 3 months in some states. But if I say I'm going to be there for this 4-day window, that's a very different ask than just asking for hunting experience or hunting permission in general. I'll say that, I'm a very respectful hunter. I'm willing to provide like landowner references if they're interested, which I think is a good message to send. But I've never had anybody take me up on that in my entire life. It's sort of an empty gesture. I would totally do it if someone's like, yeah, you know, if you could, you know, give me a few landowners whose ground you've hunted before. But I think it's signaling to them that I am like comfortable, or that I've hunted private property in the past, and I haven't had bad experiences, and I'm willing to let you talk to folks who would back that up. And so, I explain who I am. I explain why I'm sending them this letter. I try to, again, explain more about my values and tell them that I will provide references if they would like that. I'm usually... I don't think my letters message, like send this message as well, but in person or on the phone, I tell them that like, it's a beautiful property. Like as a deer hunter, I would be stoked to hunt this place. Growing up around a lot of landowners in a farming community, I don't think often they're told that like, this cornfield is a beautiful property, but in my eyes it is. I'm not lying when I say that. That's how I do feel about it. And then I thank them for their time. I try to keep it one page.
Is your Facebook or social media message strategy, or, you know, actual like the letter that you include in that, is that in any way different or same spiel?
If I'm reaching out to somebody on Facebook Messenger, that is very personal, right? It's like, dear Cynthia, hey, I know this is a weird message request, but I have a deer tag for your area, and I'll go on to sort of give the same message that I gave before. And I'll be very specific about the piece of property that I'm referencing, because in a lot of cases, people own multiple properties. And so if you're not direct about which one it is when it's, you know, this many acres off this road, it just like invites some confusion off the bat. So in that case, it's a lot more personal.
Okay. So one more follow-up on the letter thing, I guess. Mm-hmm. I'm just curious about after you get the hit. Mm-hmm. So you get the hits, you send 118, you get three yeses back, they respond. My assumption is that then you guys have a phone call or something, talk about some more details, you specify when you're going to come out there, and then you guys meet up in person. Is that right? Or have these things gone differently than that?
Yeah, I'm always offering to meet up in person, and I leave them a lot of ways to get a hold of me. I give them my phone number, tell them they can call me or they can text me. I give them my email, tell them they can email me, and then I give them my address. And if they want to write a letter back, they can do that. In most cases, I will meet up with the landowner and coordinate that way. There's a lot of coordinating that goes on, so I can, you know, shake their hand in person and maybe get a lay of the land if there happens to be something confusing with boundaries or whatever. But I leave it up to them. I will love to meet in person. But some landowners are so, you know, comfortable at that point that they're like, whenever you want to be here. Okay. It sounds good. Another thing, when I am identifying properties, something I just thought of that I do a lot, is I look for absentee landowners. And so if I'm hunting in Wyoming, it is a huge bonus for me if they have an out-of-state address. I feel like I've had more luck in those scenarios because I think those people tend to be harder to track down, especially if you're there in person. Because my preference is to knock on their door, those are a lot of cases where if the landowner lives in Iowa, but their property is in Montana, this is one of the only ways to reach them. And so I think there's less folks bugging them for hunting permission in that case. So I really like targeting absentee landowners.
And you're saying that's for the letter strategy?
Or phone calls or Facebook messages. Obviously I can't knock on their door in those cases. But when it comes to an indirect way of reaching out, I like absentee landowners a lot.
Okay. Let's pivot to the actual, you have to talk to a person strategy. Mm-hmm. So you already described how you pick your properties, but is it different at all when you are actually going to go up to the house? Like, do you in any way pick different properties when you are somewhat local or you're going to be there at some point and can show up in person? Or are you doing the same thing, looking for C-grade properties, looking for the stuff you said?
Yeah, it's almost always the same thing. And ideally, when it's an in-person deal, the address matches the actual property itself, because then that probably means that they're a farmer or that they actually work on the land. And if I swing by at a 2 p.m. on a Wednesday, they're probably home. But if that landowner has a suburban address, it's more likely that they work a 9-to-5 and they're going to be harder to get a hold of. I hope that their home is on the property and that makes it much easier to get a hold of them.
All right. So you're local, you're in Wyoming or mm-hmm. South Dakota or whatever. You found a C-grade list. What's your spiel? Some folks like to go up there and just BS for a while, and then they mention, oh, I'm also looking for this. Some folks dive right into it. What's your take?
Yeah, I tend to not waste their time, which I'm not saying that's the way. That's just my preferred way of doing it. But I'd be like, knock on your door, and I'd be like, hey, are you Mark Kenyon? And be like, yep. And be like, hey, Mike, my name is Spencer Newarth. I'm from Belgrade, Montana. I'm down here deer hunting for the next 3 days. And again, I think it's very important to lay out your timeline, because saying that you're there for the next 3 days and hunting is very different than just asking for 3 months worth of permission. So I say, I'm here for the next 3 days deer hunting. Your place looks like it would probably have some deer, and I was wondering if you let people hunt it all, and if so, if I could have hunting permission. I don't think I have a something that's like memorized, like I'm an actor, but it's close to, you know, what I just delivered to you there.
Why is it so hard for people to say no to you in person? You mentioned that that's the case. Is it, do you swoop in with the voice and you give them like the eye, and then you say, "Hey, I'm Spencer Newhart." What is it?
Well, for one, they just like, for one, they have to answer me, right? Whereas with, I said, yeah, you know, writing a letter, they can just crumble it up and throw it in the garbage and never think about it again. And I think that's often what does happen. Same with an email or a Facebook message, or if I leave that person a voicemail, it's just so easy to ignore me. And so one, I'm going to get an answer. And then I think, you know, it's one of the reasons I prefer solo hunting as well. I think it's so much less intimidating when I tell them it's just me. It's not me and my buddy. It's not me and like a party of three other guys. And so I think that's also important. They can see my truck. They know what my truck looks like at that moment. That, you know, they'll have an easier time identifying, you know, like who this stranger is on their property. So I think it's all those factors, together. And it's just, you know, harder to give somebody bad news in person, which is ultimately what they're doing, right? Like I'm looking for a yes. And it's, you know, harder for them to tell me no. And a lot of times, you know, you can like sort of sense that dread from that landowner you're talking to. They're like, "Oh, I'm really sorry." But actually, and then they'll, you know, provide whatever, you know, their valid excuses. And so I think it's all those factors baked into, you know, that it really ups your odds if you're there face to face.
Yeah. So I wouldn't call these tricks, but like little things that help. Like I mentioned that I'll always try to find a reference point, somehow connect me to the area. I'll always, you know, never end a conversation if they want to keep going with it, right? Because you never know what might happen by the end of it.
Yeah.
The little trick I mentioned where I'll always ask them to refer me to the next place.
Yep.
Those are a few like my little things that have worked. Do you have any other little tricks or angles or like best practices that have kind of helped you above and beyond what we've talked about?
Yeah. Man, I think all those things that I've mentioned already are kind of my tricks. Again, like it helps if you're there on your own, or if you have like a kid who wants to hunt, that's probably a scenario where it is better to have more people there. Yeah, I think.
What do you wear?
I don't think about that too much. I know a lot of guys say that they don't like to wear their camo. I've tried to like identify if that helps or hurts my odds, and I don't think it does either one. So if I happen to be wearing camo, you know, like I'll wear the camo that I have on while I'm there. I think something that benefits me is I did grow up in a small farming community of 600 people. And, you know, I knew every farmer in the area, and a lot of my family farmed. And so I can speak a little bit of farm, not a lot, but like to a certain level, I can speak farm with the farmer.
Can you give me an example? Can you give me an example? Yeah, I'm Farmer Kenyon.
yeah, just whatever's like seasonal at that time. Be like, "Oh, so, you know, you guys, you know, talk about the harvest," or if it happens to be calving season, talk about calving a little bit or whatever. I don't know that I can give specific examples.
That's a nice bushel you got over there.
Yeah, sure. There you go. That's a good example. But I can like, you know, it's always specific to whatever's happening there, but I can speak a little bit of farm. And I think that happens as well, because again, in these scenarios, you know, it's better for them to not think of me as a stranger from Bozeman. And if I can talk a little farm with them about harvest or cattle or grain prices or whatever, that's to my benefit. And I think that, you know, makes them more comfortable with the whole situation, that I'm not going to like ruin their fence or do something totally idiotic like that.
Yeah, 100% agree. So you gave me a perfect segue to the last thing I wanted to ask you about. You've hunted a lot of different places now by permission.
Yep.
Met with a lot of different landowners. I think a really important thing that anyone who wants to get permission to hunt somebody else's land needs to really think about is how to make sure they use that person's land respectfully, mm-hmm. right? Can you leave us with a few of your best practices for making sure that you maintain a good relationship with the landowner and use their property respectfully, properly, in the ways they want?
Yeah, I think one of the biggest things most landowners are concerned about, like where you're driving, and I will like basically neuter that conversation before it can happen, and tell them to like, yeah, I'm just looking to walk. You know, I'm not going to be driving anywhere, and so I think. In a lot of cases, even the landowner would be like, yeah, you know, there's paths all over you can take or whatever, or just like, you know, watch when you drive through that one pasture, there's some ruts. So I tell them I'm not going to drive anywhere. Yeah, I think if, you know, be conscious about conditions. One of the worst things you can do is if you are driving around, if they have like a dirt road that they themselves are responsible for maintaining, don't drive down it when it's muddy or something like that. You're going to create ruts that are a problem then as soon as that dries and until like the landowner comes through and fixes that. So yeah, I think foot traffic is very important to these people. So know that, you know, you're still going to be walking. Yeah. Being by yourself. I think if you can be specific about where, you know, you'd like to hunt or what part of the property you're interested in, that'll ease their mind about, shooting one of their horses or their cattle, or something like that.
Make sure you don't shoot when there's a house behind where you're shooting at.
Yes, I've heard that is that strong advice that shouldn't do that. Yep.
At least from the camera angle, mm-hmm. right?
Yep.
Oh man, no, this is a really, really good advice, buddy.
I think maybe what's to my advantage the most is I am often hunting in places where the whitetail is significantly less respected than in other parts of the country. It's the reason I love Western whitetails, and why when I'm planning my fall, I'm often hunting west of the Missouri River, right? I love hunting in the Dakotas and Nebraska and Montana and Wyoming. And this year I got a whitetail tag for Idaho. And my plan for Idaho is to knock on a lot of doors and get permissions because
Don't come to my place.
Okay. You're not going to, yeah, I'll find, find Onyx and I'm not going to knock on Mark Kenyon's door. But these people just
get the hell out of here. Mm-hmm,
they tend to really not care about whitetails. Well, I shouldn't say, in some cases you're far more likely to find a landowner who's like, yeah, you want to hunt whitetails? Go ahead. Yeah. I don't care. If I was asking for elk hunting permission, right, that'd be a totally different story. And I've never asked for elk hunting permission, anywhere because I think, you know, that'd be the equivalent of asking for whitetail hunting permission in like northern Missouri or southern Iowa. It's just significantly less likely, to happen in a place where the whitetail is held to a very high regard. And so that's, you know, why I love hunting whitetails out here. You're just generally dealing with folks who don't give a crap. And you'll often hear the line that's like, sure, but, you know, you can only hunt if you shoot five of them or something like that. Yeah, just because in some cases, their stance on whitetails is not only neutral, but it's negative. Like, yeah, you know, they're driving out the mule deer. They're eating all my hay bales or whatever. And so that's, you know, I think for the listeners, know that that should be the lens you see it through. And when I'm giving this advice is I'm often, getting a enormous head start by seeking whitetail hunting permission in the places that I do.
Yeah. But your stuff worked in Texas even too, right?
That was a weird situation where, I sent out letters to, Texas landowners, which was a different animal.
That seems very low odds.
Yes. Well, what ended up happening was, a landowner that I got permission from in Montana happened to also have land in Texas, that I went down and I hunted. But I also, I tried Texas, It wasn't near as successful. And I lived in Illinois for a while, right? And that was the hardest place for me to get permission. In fact, I got zero permission when I lived in Illinois. So the advice that I'm giving has worked for left of the Missouri River, but it's probably less likely to work on the right side. But, you know, there's certainly things that you can do that would be very specific to your region to work. And I think the last thing I would say is, you know, I feel like in the business world, they say like always be networking or whatever. That's how I am with hunting permissions. When I'm at a wedding and, you know, the small talk starts with a stranger, I'm always like trying to feel them out for if they own land or not. If I'm at a bar and I belly up next to somebody who, you know, we start talking to, I'm always, always looking for hunting permission. And so I think that's something to do no matter what part of the country you live in.
Yeah. Yeah. Very, very good advice. And I want to make a point to say that even though your experience set has been west of the Mississippi River, or Missouri River, I think it's the Mississippi, everything you said absolutely works east of it too. Like you're very much in line with my approach in a lot of ways, and it has worked east of the Mississippi. It's just like it's a numbers game that is different. So it might work 1 out of 10 times for you west, and it might work, you know, 1 out of 100 times to the east. So it's just a matter of like, you just have to have a larger sample size when you're trying to do it out here.
Yep.
But I think it's really, really good advice. So I appreciate you sharing this, Spencer. And I do want to give you a chance. Do you want to plug any specific trivia episodes? Is there anything fun coming up in the trivia world? The game, anything else? Mm-hmm. Ooh, can you plug something coming on the game yet or no?
Not yet. We came out with the board game last fall, and I'll say this, there are more new trivia related board game products coming out this fall. You know, we'll probably announce them this summer, and they'll be for sale in October or November. and I hope that they'll find a place in your deer camp. And if you don't have a deer camp, I hope they'll find a place, in the glove box of your pickup. Because this game is mobile. It was made by a deer hunter, for deer hunters. And it's not exclusively for the kitchen table. It can go wherever you go, and our products coming out this year will also reflect that.
Awesome, man. Well, great job with the podcast. Great job with the board game.
Yeah.
We are going to be playing it at our turkey camp coming up here in a few weeks. So it will find its way to probably the top of a cooler or something in a barn.
Good.
With a bunch of guys hunting.
Glad to hear that. So. Last thing I would say, Mark, is when it happens for you and you get permission and you've hunted their place, just like go way, way over the top with how excited you are and how gracious you are. And, you know, in my case, I don't have to fake it because I am stoked, and I do appreciate, you know, the opportunity they've given me and make it very clear that like you are thrilled to haunt this place and you're very thankful. And it'd be like, you know, if you were a guest on a podcast and you were like, man, Mark, it was a pleasure. This was so much fun. Thank you. You've got a beautiful show here. Yeah, I had, you know, the time of my life. I really appreciate you letting me be a guest here. And yeah, next time I would love to do this again. If you'd allow me to hunt again in the future or be a guest again in the future, you know, would mean the world to me.
Well, so here's the thing, though. Now I don't know, like, are you just saying that because you want to get invited again in the future? Or did you really enjoy it?
I don't know, Mark. if you don't know, then I think I did a good job.
You did, Spencer. Thank you.
Thanks, Mark.
All right, that is a wrap. Thanks for tuning in. Thank you for being a part of this community. Thanks for making this something that I'm excited about every day. And I'd say until next time, let's stay wired to hunt.
Hey everybody, listen up. I got mega huge news. Meat Eater Live is heading back out on the road. That's right, join me and the crew. Clay Newcomb, Cal, Yanni, Spencer's gonna be there. Phil the Engineer's gonna be there. Meat Eater Live, headed back out. Now, when you get every ticket, okay? Every ticket you buy, you get a signed copy of our new Meat Eater Outdoor Cookbook. This tour is celebrating the release of the book. Buy a ticket, get a signed copy, Meat Eater Outdoor Cookbook, wild game recipes for the grill, smoker, camp stove, and campfire, which I'll point out is a $38 value. Here's where we're going to go. April 23rd, the Mesa Arts Center in Mesa, Arizona. April 24th, the Balboa Theater in San Diego. April 25th, the Grove in Anaheim, California. April 27th, the Crest Theater in Sacramento. April 29th, the Union in Salt Lake City. April 30th, the Egyptian in Boise. May 1st, the Wilma Theater in Missoula. May 2nd, the Bing Crosby Theater in Spokane, Washington. May 4th, Revolution Hall in Portland, Oregon. And May 5th, the last day of the tour, Pantages Theater in Tacoma, Washington. For tickets and more information, visit the events page at themeateater.com. Hope to see you at the show.